middle at the last instant, narrowly saving him from a tumble down the steps.
"Long story. Everybody."
Baron cast a backward glance at the tavern, shouted something to the barmaid, and charged up the steps, a rag thrown over his shoulder. Together they hoisted Kell's soaking body up the remaining stairs and into the little room at the top. Baron held his tongue as they stripped away Kell's wet coat and stained shirt and laid him down on Lila's bed. He didn't ask her where she'd found this stranger, or why there was no wound to explain the blood trail he'd left on the tavern stairs, though the gash across his ribs was still quite angry. When Lila scoured the room for something to burn, in case the rain had not been enough to hide their scent, in case it still lingered here from earlier that night, and came up empty, Baron didn't ask, only went to fetch some herbs from the kitchen below. He watched silently as she held a bowl of them over a candle, and let the room fill with an earthy smell that had nothing to do with Kell or Holland or magic. He stayed as she dug through the pockets of Kell's coat, which turned out to be several coats somehow folded into one, in search of something, anything, that might help mend him. He was a magician, after all, and it stood to reason that magicians carried around magic. And Baron said nothing when at last she dug the black stone from her pocket and dropped it in a small wooden box, setting a handful of warm herbs inside before shoving the lot into the bottom drawer of her chest. It wasn't until Lila slumped down into the chair at the foot of the bed and began to clean her pistol that Baron finally spoke.
"What are you doing with this man?"
His eyes were dark and narrow. Lila looked up from her gun.
"You know him?"
"In a way," said Baron archly.
"You know what he is, then?" she asked.
"Do you?"
challenged Baron.
"In a way,"
she retorted.
"First I took him for a mark."
Baron ran a hand through his hair, and Lila realized for the first time that it was thinning.
"Christ, Lila," he muttered. "What did you take?"
Her gaze flicked to the bottom drawer of the chest, then drifted back to Kell. He looked deathly pale against the dark blanket on her bed, and he wasn't moving, save for the faint rise and fall of his chest. She took him in, the magical young man in her bed, first so guarded, now exposed, vulnerable. Her eyes trailed up the lines of his stomach, over his wounded ribs, across his throat. They wandered down his arms, bare but for the knife strapped to his forearm. She hadn't touched it this time.
"What happened?" asked Baron.
Lila wasn't entirely sure how to answer that. It had been a very strange night.
"I stole something and he came looking for it," she said quietly, unable to draw her eyes from Kell's face.
He looked younger, asleep.
"Took it back? I thought that was the end of that. But someone else came looking for him. Found me instead."
She trailed off, then picked up.
"He saved my life,"
she said half to herself, brow crinkling.
"I don't know why."
"So you brought him here?"
"I'm sorry," said Lila, turning toward Baron. "I didn't have anywhere else to go."
The words stung even as she said them.
"As soon as he wakes," Baron was shaking his head.
"I'd rather you here than dead. The person who did this,"
he waved a hand at Kell's body.
"Are they dead?"
Lila shook her head. Baron frowned.
"Best tell me what they look like so I know not to let them in."
Lila described Holland as best she could. His faded appearance. His two-toned eyes.
"He feels like Kell," she added. "If that makes sense. Like..."
"Magic,"
said Baron matter-of-factly. Lila's eyes widened.
"How do you..."
"Run in a tavern, you meet all kinds. Run in this tavern, you meet all kinds, and then some."
Lila realized she was shivering, and Baron went in search of another tunic for Kell while she changed. He came back with an extra towel, a small pile of clothes, and a steaming bowl of soup. Lila felt ill and grateful at the same time. Baron's kindness was like a curse, because she knew she had done nothing to deserve it. It wasn't fair. Baron did not owe her anything, yet she owed him so much. Too much. It drove her mad. Still, her hunger had finally caught up with her fatigue, and the cold in her skin was quickly becoming the cold in her bones. So she took the soup and mumbled a thank you, and added the cost to the coin she already owed, as if this kind of debt could ever be paid. Baron left them and went below. Outside, the night wore on. The rain wore on, too. She didn't remember sitting down, but she woke up an hour or so later in her wooden chair with a blanket tossed over her shoulders. She was stiff, and Kell was still asleep. Lila rolled her neck and sat forward.
"Why did you come back?"
she asked again, as if Kell might answer in his sleep. But he didn't. Didn't mumble, didn't toss or turn. He just lay there, so pale and so still that now and then Lila would hold a piece of glass to his lips to make sure he hadn't died. His bare chest rose and fell, and she noticed that, present injuries aside, he had so few scars. A faint line at his shoulder, a much fresher one across his palm, a ghosted mark in the crook of his elbow. Lila had too many scars to count, but she could count Kell's. And she did. Several times. The tavern below had quieted, and Lila got to her feet and burned a few more herbs. She turned her silver watch and waited for Kell to wake. Sleep dragged at her bones, but every time she thought of rest, she imagined Holland stepping through her wall the way Kell had. Pain echoed through her arm where he'd gripped her, a small jagged burn the only relic, and her fingers went to the flintlock at her hip. If she had another shot, she wouldn't miss. 8. An Arrangement. 1. Kell woke up in Lila's bed for the second time that night. Though at least this time he discovered there were no ropes. His hands rested at his sides, bound by nothing but the rough blanket that had been cast over him. It took him a moment to remember that it was Lila's room, Lila's bed, to piece together the memory of Holland and the alley and the blood. And afterward, Lila's grip and her voice, as steady as the rain. The rain had stopped falling now, and low morning light was creeping into the sky, and for a moment all Kell wanted was to be home. Not in the shoddy room in the ruby fields, but at the palace. He closed his eyes and could almost hear Rye pounding on his door, telling him to get dressed because the carriages were waiting. And so were the people. "Get ready or get left behind," Rye would say, bursting into the room. "Then leave me," Kell would groan. "Not a chance," Rye would answer, wearing his best prince's grin. "Not today." A cart clattered past outside and Kell blinked, Rye fading back into nothing. Were they worried about him yet, the royal family? Did they have any idea what was happening? How could they? Even Kell did not know. He knew only that he had the stone, and that he needed to be rid of it. He tried to sit up, but his body cried out, and he had to bite his tongue to keep from voicing it. His skin, his muscle, his very bones, everything ached in a steady, horrible way as if he were nothing but a bruise. Even the beat of his heart in his chest and the pulse of his blood through his veins felt sore, strained. He felt like death. It was as close as he had ever come, and closer than he ever wished to be. When the pain, or at least the novelty of it, lessened, he forced himself upright, bracing a hand against the headboard. He fought to focus his vision, and when he managed, he found himself looking squarely into Lila's eyes. she was sitting in that same chair at the foot of the bed, her pistol in her lap.
"Why did you do it?"
she asked, the question primed on her tongue as if she'd been waiting. Kell squinted.
"Do what?"
"Come back,"
she said, the words low.
"Why did you come back?"
Two words hung in the air, unsaid but understood. "For me." Kell fought to drag his thoughts together, but even they were as stiff and sore as the rest of him.
"I don't know."
Lila seemed unimpressed by the answer, but she only sighed and returned her weapon to the holster of her waist.
"How are you feeling?"
"Like hell," thought Kell. But then he looked down at himself and realized that despite his aching body, the wound at his arm where the nail had driven through, as well as the one across his stomach from the cutthroat stolen sword, were nearly healed.
"How long was I asleep?"
"A few hours," said Lila.
Kell ran a hand gingerly over his ribs. That didn't make sense. Cuts this deep took days to mend, not hours. Not unless he had a...
"I use this,"
said Lila, tossing a circular tin his way. Kell plucked it out of the air, wincing a little as he did. The container was unmarked, but he recognized it at once. The small metal tin contained a healing salve. Not just any healing salve, but one of his own. The royal emblem of the chalice and rising sun embossed on its lid. He'd misplaced it weeks ago.
"Where did you get this?" he asked.
"In a pocket in your coat," said Lila, stretching. "By the way, did you know that your coat is more than one coat? I'm pretty sure I went through 5 or 6 to find that."
Kell stared at her, slack-jawed.
"What?"
she asked.
"How did you know what it was for?"
Lila shrugged.
"I didn't."
"What if it had been poison?" he snapped.
"There's really no winning with you,"
she snapped back.
"It smelled fine. It seemed fine."
Kell groaned.
"And obviously I tested on myself first."
"You did what?"
Lila crossed her arms.
"I'm not repeating myself just so you can gape and glare."
Kell shook his head, cursing under his breath, as she nodded at a pile of clothes at the foot of the bed.
"Baron brought those for you."
Kell frowned. Saints, even his brow hurt when it furrowed. He and Baron had a business arrangement. He was pretty sure it didn't cover shelter and personal necessities. He would owe him for the trouble. And it was trouble. Both of them knew it. Kell could feel Lila's eyes hanging on him as he reached for the clean tunic and shrugged it gingerly over his shoulders.
"What is it?" he asked.
"You said no one would follow you."
"I said no one could," corrected Kell. "Because no one can, except for Holland."
Kell looked at his hands and frowned.
"I just never thought..."
"One is not the same thing as none, Kell," said Lila.
And then she let out a breath and ran a hand through her cropped dark hair.
"But I suppose you didn't exactly have all your wits about you."
Kell looked up in surprise. Was she actually excusing him?
"And I did hit you with a book."
"What?"
"Nothing,"
said Lila, waving her hand.
"So, this Holland... he's like you."
Kell swallowed, remembering Holland's words in the alley.
"We may share an ability, you and I, but that does not make us equals."
And the dark, almost disdainful look that crossed his face when he said it. He thought of the brand burned into the other Antari's skin and the patchwork of scars on his arms, and the White King's smug smile as Holland pressed the knife into his skin. No, Holland was nothing like Kell, and Kell was nothing like Holland. "He can also move between worlds," explained Kell. "In that way, we are alike."
"And the eye?"
questioned Lila.
"A mark of our magic," said Kell. "And Tari. That is what we are called. Blood magicians."
Lila chewed her lip.
"Are there any others I should know about?"
she asked, and Kel thought he saw a sliver of something, fear, cross her features, buried almost instantly behind the stubborn set of her jaw. Kel shook his head slowly.
"No," he said. "We are the only two."
He expected her to look relieved, but her expression only grew graver.
"Is that why he didn't kill you?"
"What do you mean?"
Lila sat forward in her chair.
"Well, if he wanted to kill you, he could have. Why bleed you dry? For the fun of it? He didn't seem to be enjoying himself."
She was right. Holland could have slit his throat. But he hadn't. "It's really quite hard to kill Antari," Holland's words echoed in Kel's head. "But I can't have..."
"Can't have what?"
wondered Kel. Ending an Antari's life might be hard, but it wasn't impossible. Had Holland been fighting against his orders or following them?
"Kel?"
pressed Lila.
"Holland never enjoys himself," he said under his breath, and then he looked up sharply. "Where is the stone now?"
Lila gave him a long, weighing look and then said,
"I have it."
"Then give it back,"
demanded Kel, surprising himself with his own urgency. He told himself it would be safest on his person, but in truth, he wanted to hold it. Couldn't shake the sense that if he did, his aching muscles would be soothed and his weak blood strengthened. She rolled her eyes.
"Not this again."
"Lila, listen to me. You've no idea what..."
"Actually,"
she cut in, getting to her feet,
"I'm starting to get a decent idea of what it can do. If you want it back, tell me the rest."
"You wouldn't understand," said Kel automatically.
"Try me," she challenged.
Kel squinted at her, this strange girl. Lila Bard did seem to have a way of figuring things out. She was still alive, that said something, and she'd come back for him. He didn't know why. Cutthroats and thieves weren't usually known for their moral compasses. But he did know that without her he would be in a far worse state.
"Very well,"
said Kel, swinging his legs off the bed.
"The stone is from a place known as Black London."
"You mentioned other Londons,"
she said, as if the concept were curious but not entirely impossible. She didn't phase easily.
"How many are there?"
Kel ran a hand through his auburn hair. It stuck up at odd angles from rain and sleep.
"There are four worlds," he said. "Think of them as different houses built on the same foundation. They have little in common save for their geography and the fact that each has a version of this city straddling this river on this island country, and in each, that city is called London."
"That must be confusing."
"It isn't really, when you live in only one of them and never need to think of the others. But as someone who moves between, I use colour to keep them straight. Grey London, which is yours. Red London, which is mine. White London, which is Holland's, and Black London, which is no one's."
"And why's that?"
"Because it fell," said Kel, rubbing the back of his neck where the pendant cords had snapped. "Lost to darkness. The first thing about magic that you have to understand, Lila, is that it is not inanimate. It is alive. Alive in a different way than you or I, but still very much alive."
"Is that why it got angry?"
she asked.
"When I tried to get rid of it?"
Kel frowned. He'd never seen magic that alive.
"Nearly 3 centuries ago,"
he said slowly, working out the math. It seemed further away, the effect of being so long referred to as simply the past. "The four worlds were twined together. Magic and those who wielded it able to move between them with relative ease through any one of the many sources."
"Sources?"
"Pools of immense natural power," explained Kel. Some small,
discreet, a copse of trees in the Far East, a ravine on the continent. Others,
vast, like your Thames.
The Thames?
Said Lila with a derisive snort.
A source of magic?
Perhaps the greatest source in the world, said Kel. Not that you'd know it here, but if you could see it, as it is in my London.
Kel trailed off. As I was saying, the doors between the worlds were open and the four cities of London intermingled. But even with constant transference, they were not entirely equal in their power. If true magic were a fire, then Black London sat closest to the heat. By this logic, White London stood second in strength, and Kel knew it must have, though he could not imagine it now. It was believed that the power there not only ran strong in the blood, but pulsed like a second soul through everything. And at some point it grew too strong and overthrew its host. The world sits in balance, said Kel. Humanity in one hand, magic in the other. The two exist in every living thing, and in a perfect world they maintained a kind of harmony, neither exceeding the other. But most worlds are not perfect. In Grey London, your London, humanity grew strong and magic weak. But in Black London, it was the other way around. The people there not only held magic in their bodies, they let magic into their minds. And it took them as its own, burning up their lives to fuel its power. They became vessels, conduits for its will, and through them it twisted whim into reality, blurring the lines, breaking them down, creating and destroying and corrupting everything. Lila said nothing, only listened and paced. It spread like a plague, continued Kel, and the other three remaining worlds retreated into themselves and locked their doors to prevent the spread of sickness. He did not say that it had been Red London's retreat, its sealing off of itself, that forced the other cities to follow, and left White London pinned between their closed doors and Black London's seething magic. He did not say that the world caught between was forced to fight the darkness back alone. With the sources restricted and the doors locked, the remaining three cities were isolated and began to diverge, each becoming as they are now. But what became of Black London and the rest of its world, we can only guess. Magic requires a living host. It can thrive only where life does too, so most assume that the plague burned through its host and eventually ran out of kindling, leaving only charred remains. None know for sure. Over time, Black London became a ghost story, a fairy tale, told so many times that some don't even think it real. The stone? Said Lila, still pacing. The stone shouldn't exist, said Kel. Once the doors were sealed, every relic from Black London was tracked down and destroyed as a precaution.
Obviously not every relic, observed Lila.
Kel shook his head. White London supposedly undertook the task with even more fervor than we did. You must understand, they feared the doors would not hold. Feared the magic would break through and consume them. In their cleanse, they did not stop at objects and artifacts. They slit the throats of everyone they even suspected of possessing, of having come in contact with Black London's corrupted magic. Kel brought his fingers to his blackened eye.
It is said that some mistook Antari's marks for such corruption and dragged them from their houses in the night. An entire generation slaughtered before they realized that without the doors, such magicians would be their only way of reaching out.
Kel's hand fell away.
But no, obviously not every relic was destroyed.
He wondered if that was how it had been broken. If they'd tried and failed and buried it, wondered if someone new had dug it up.
The stone shouldn't exist, and it can't be allowed to exist.
It's... Lila stopped pacing.
Evil?
Kalt shook his head.
No, he said. It is Vitari. In a way, I suppose it is pure.
But it is pure potential, pure power,
pure magic.
And no humanity, said Lila. No harmony. Kel nodded.
Purity without balance is its own corruption.
The damage this talisman could manage in the wrong hands.
In anyone's hands, he thought. The stone's magic is the magic of a ruined world. It cannot stay here.
Well, said Lila, what do you intend to do?
Kel closed his eyes.
He didn't know who had come across the stone or how, but he understood their fear. The memory of it in Holland's hands, and the thought of it in Athos's or Astrid's, turned his stomach. His own skin sang for the talisman, thirsted for it, and that scared him more than anything else. Black London fell because of magic like this. What horror would it bring to the Londons that remained? To the starving white, or the ripened red, or the defenceless grey? No, the stone had to be destroyed. But how? It wasn't like other relics. It wasn't a thing to be tossed in a fire or crushed beneath an axe. It looked as though someone had tried, but the broken edge did not seem to diminish its function, which meant that even if he did succeed in shattering it, it might only make more pieces, rendering every shard its own weapon. It was no mere token. The stone had a life and a will of its own, and had shown so more than once. Only strong magic would be able to unmake such a thing, but as the talisman was magic itself, he doubted that magic could ever be made to destroy it. Cal's head ached with the realization that it could not be ruined. It had to be disposed of. Sent away. Somewhere it could do no damage. And there was only one place it would be safe. And everyone safe from it. Cal knew what he had to do. Some part of him had known since the moment the stone had passed into his hands. "It belongs in Black London," he said. "I have to take it back."
Lila cocked her head.
"But how can you? You don't know what's left of it, and even if you did, you said the world was sealed off."
"I don't know what's left of it, no, but Antari magic was originally used to make the doors between the worlds, and Antari magic would have been used to seal them shut. And so it stands to reason that Antari magic could open them again. Or at least create a crack."
"Then why haven't you?"
challenged Lila, a glint in her eye.
"Why hasn't anyone? I know you're a rare breed, but you cannot tell me that in the century since you locked yourselves out, no Antari has been curious enough to try and get back in."
Kel considered her defiant smile, and was grateful for humanity's sake that she lacked the magic to try. As for Kel, of course, he'd been curious. Growing up, a small part of him never believed Black London was real, or that it had ever been. The doors had been sealed for so long. What child didn't wish to know if his bedtime stories were the stuff of fiction or of truth? But even if he'd wanted to break the seal, and he didn't, not enough to risk the darkness on the other side, he'd never had a way.
"Maybe some were curious enough," said Kel. "But an Antari needs two things to make a door. The first is blood, the second is a token from the place they want to go to. And as I told you, the tokens were all destroyed."
Lila's eyes widened.
"But the stone is a token."
"The stone is a token," echoed Kel.
Lila gestured to the wall where Kel had first come in.
"So you open a door to Black London, and what? Throw the stone in? What on earth have you been waiting for?"
Kel shook his head. "I can't make a door from here to there."
Lila let out an exasperated noise.
"But you just said..."
"The other Londons sit between," he explained.
A small book rested on the table by the bed. He brushed his thumb over the pages. "The worlds are like pieces of paper," he said, "stacked one on top of the other." That's how he'd always thought of it. "You have to move in order." He pinched a few pages between his fingers. "Grey London," he said, letting one fall back to the stack. "Red London." He let go of a second. "White London." The third page fluttered as it fell. "And black." He let the rest of the pages fall back to the book.
"So you'll have to go through," said Lila.
It sounded so simple when she put it like that. But it wouldn't be. No doubt the Crown was searching for him in Red London, and saints only knew who else. Had Holland compelled others there? Were they searching too? And without his pendants, he'd have to hunt down a new trinket to get from there to White London. And once he made it that far, if he made it that far, and assuming the Danes weren't on him in an instant, and assuming he was able to overcome the seal and open a door to Black London, the stone couldn't simply be thrown in. Doors didn't work that way. Kell would have to go with it. He tried not to think about that.
"So," said Lila, eyes glittering, "when do we go?"
Kell looked up.
"We don't."
Lila was leaning back against the wall just beside the place he'd cuffed her to the wood. The board was ripped and ruined where she'd hacked herself free, as if reminding him both of his actions and of hers.
"I want to come," she insisted. "I won't tell you where the stone is, not until you agree to let me."
Kell's hands curled into fists. "Those binds you summoned up for Holland won't hold. Antari magic is strong enough to dispel them, and once he wakes, it won't take him long to realize that and free himself and start hunting us down again. Which means I don't have time for games."
"It's not a game," she said simply.
"Then what is it?"
"A chance," she pushed off the wall.
"A way out." Her calm shifted, and for a moment Kell glimpsed the things beneath. The want, the fear, the desperation.
"You want out," he said, "but you have no idea what you're getting into."
"I don't care," she said. "I want to come."
"You can't,"
he said, pushing to his feet. A shallow wave of dizziness hit him, and he braced himself against the bed, waiting for it to pass. She gave a mocking laugh.
"You're in no shape to go alone."
"You can't come, Lila," he said again. "Only Antari can move between the worlds."
"That rock of mine..."
"It's not yours."
"It is right now. And you said yourself, it's pure magic. It makes magic. It will let me through."
She said it as if she were certain.
"What if it won't?" he challenged. "What if it isn't all-powerful? What if it's only a trinket to conjure up small spells?"
But she didn't seem to believe him. He wasn't sure he believed himself. He had held the stone. He had felt its power, and it felt limitless. But he did not wish for Lila to test it.
"You cannot know for sure."
"That's my risk to take, not yours."
Kell stared at her.
"Why?"
he asked.
Lila shrugged. "I'm a wanted man."
"You're not a man."
Lila flashed a hollow smile.
"The authorities don't know that yet. Probably while I'm still wanted instead of hanged."
Kell refused to let it go.
"Why do you really want to do this?"
"Because I'm a fool."
"Lila."
"Because I can't stay here,"
she snapped, the smile gone from her face.
"Because I want to see the world, even if it's not mine. And because I will save your life."
Madness, thought Kell, absolute madness. She wouldn't make it through the door, and even if the stone worked, even if she somehow did, what then? Transference was treason, and Kell was fairly certain that law extended to people, particularly fugitives. Smuggling a music box was one thing, but smuggling a thief was quite another. And smuggling a relic of Black London? chided a voice in Kell's head. He rubbed his eyes. He could feel hers fixed on him. Treason aside, the fact remained that she was a grey worlder. She didn't belong in his London. It was too dangerous. It was mad, and he'd be mad to let her try. But Lila was right about one thing. Kell did not feel strong enough to do this alone, and worse, he did not want to. He was afraid, more afraid than he wanted to admit about the task ahead of him and the fate that waited at its end. And someone would need to tell the Red Throne, tell his mother and father and Rai what had happened. He could not bring this danger to their doorstep, but he could leave Lila there to tell them of it. "You don't know anything about these worlds," he said. But the fight was bleeding out of his voice.
"Sure I do," countered Lila cheerfully. "There's Dull London, Kell London, Creepy London and Dead London," she recited, ticking them off on her fingers. "See? I'm a fast learner."
"You're all so human," thought Kell. "A strange, stubborn, cutthroat human, but human all the same." Light, thin and watered down by rain, was beginning to creep into the sky. He couldn't afford to stand here waiting her out.
"Give me the stone," he said, "and I'll let you come."
Lila bit back a sharp laugh.
"I think I'll hold on to it until we're through."
"And if you don't survive," challenged Kell.
"Then you can raid my corpse," she said dryly. "I doubt I'll care."
Kell stared at her at a loss. Was her bravado a front, or did she truly have so little to lose? But she had a life, and a life was a thing that could always be lost. How could she fear nothing, even death? "Are you afraid of dying?" Holland had asked him in the alley. And Kell was, had always been, ever since he could remember. He feared not living, feared ceasing to exist. Lila's world may believe in heaven and hell, but his believed in dust. He was taught early that magic reclaimed magic and earth reclaimed earth, the two dividing when the body died. The person they had combined to be simply forfeit, lost. Nothing lasted. Nothing remained. Growing up, he had nightmares in which he suddenly broke apart. One minute running through the courtyard or standing on the palace steps, the next scattered into air and ash. He'd wake sweat-soaked and gasping, Rai shaking his shoulder. "Aren't you afraid of dying?" he asked Lila now. She looked at him as if it were a strange question, and then she shook her head.
"Death comes for everyone," she said simply. "I'm not afraid of dying. But I am afraid of dying here."
She swept her hand over the room, the tavern, the city.
"I'd rather die on an adventure than live standing still."
Kell considered her for a long moment. And then he said,
"Very well."
Lila's brow crinkled distrustfully.
"What do you mean, very well?"
"You can come," clarified Kell.
Lila broke into a grin. It lit up her face in a whole new way, made her look young. Her eyes went to the window.
"The sun is almost up," she said, "and Holland's likely looking for us by now."
"Are you well enough to go?" she asked. "It's really quite hard to kill Antari." Kell nodded as Lila pulled the cloak around her shoulders and holstered her weapons, moving with brisk, efficient motions, as if afraid that if she took too long, he would revoke the offer. He only stood there, marvelling.
"Don't you want to say goodbye?"
he asked, gesturing at the floorboards and somewhere beneath them, Baron. Lila hesitated, considering her boots and the world below them.
"No,"
she said softly, her voice uncertain for the first time since they'd met. He didn't know how Lila's and Baron's threads were tangled, but he let the issue lie. He did not blame her, After all, he had no plans to detour to the palace to see his brother one last time. He told himself that it was too dangerous, or that Rye would not let him go, but it was as much the truth that Kell could not bring himself to say goodbye. Kell's coat was hanging on the chair, and he crossed to it and turned it inside out from left to right, exchanging the worn black for ruby red. Interest flickered like a light behind Lila's eyes, but never truly showed, and he supposed she'd seen the trick herself when she went searching through his pockets in the night.
"How many coats do you suppose there are inside that one?"
she asked casually, as if inquiring about the weather and not a complex enchantment.
"I'm not exactly sure," said Kell, digging in a gold-embroidered pocket and sighing inwardly with relief as his fingers skimmed a spare coin. "Every now and then I think I've found them all, and then I stumble on a new one. And sometimes old ones get lost.
A couple of years ago, I came across a short coat, an ugly green thing with patched elbows, but I haven't seen it since." He drew the red lion lin from the coat and kissed it. Coins made perfect dorkies. In theory, anything from a world would do. Most of what Kell wore came from Red London, but coins were simple, solid, specific, and guaranteed to work. He couldn't afford to muddy this up, not when a second life was on his hands. And it was, no matter what she claimed. While he'd been searching for the token, Lila had emptied the money from her own pockets, a rather eclectic assortment of shillings, pennies and farthings, and piled them on the dresser by her bed. Kell reached out and plucked a halfpenny off its stack to replace the grey token he'd lost, while Lila chewed her lip and stared down at the coins a moment, hands thrust into the inner pockets of her cloak. She was fiddling with something there, and a few moments later she pulled out an elegant silver watch and set it beside the pile of coins.
"I'm ready,"
she said, tearing her eyes from the timepiece. "I'm not," thought Kell, shrugging on his coat and crossing to the door. Another smaller wave of dizziness hit, but it passed sooner than the last as he opened the door.
"Wait," said Lila. "I thought we'd go the way you came. By the wall."
"Walls aren't always where they ought to be," answered Kell.
In truth, the stone's throw was one of the only places where the walls didn't change, but that made it no safer. The setting sun may sit on the same foundation in Red London, but it was also the place where Kell did business, and one of the first places someone might come looking for him.
"Besides, we don't know what,
or who," he amended, remembering the attackers under their compulsion, "is waiting on the other side. Better get closer to where we're going before we go there. Understand?" Lila looked as though she didn't, but nodded all the same. The two crept down the stairs past a small landing that branched off down a narrow hall studded with rooms. Lila paused beside the nearest door and listened. A low rumbling snore came through the wood. Barren. She touched the door briefly, then pushed past Callan down the remaining stairs without looking back. She slid the bolt on the back entrance and hurried into the alley. Kell followed her out, stopping long enough to raise his hand and will the metal lock back into place behind them. He listened to the shk of metal sliding home, then turned to find Lila waiting, her back purposely to the tavern, as if her present were already her past. 2. The rain had ended and left the streets dreary and damp. But despite the wet ground and the October chill, London was beginning to drag itself awake. The sound of rickety carts filled the air, met with the smell of fresh bread and new fires, and merchants and buyers began the slow revival of work, pinning back the doors and shutters of shops and readying their businesses for the day. Cal and Lila made their way through the rousing city, moving briskly in the thin dawn light.
"You sure you have the stone?" pressed Kell.
"Yes,"
said Lila, lips quirking.
"And if you're thinking of stealing it back, I would advise against it." As you'd have to search me, a magic or no, I'm willing to bet my knife could find your heart before your hand could find the rock.
She said it with such casual confidence that Kell suspected she might be right, but he had no desire to find out. Instead, he turned his attention to the streets around them, trying to picture them as if they were a world away.
"We're nearly there."
"Where's there?" she asked.
"Whitbury Street," he said.
He'd crossed through at Whitbury before. It put him near his rooms at the Ruby Fields, which meant that he could drop any newly acquired items before reporting to the palace. But, more important, the row of shops on Whitbury did not sit directly on top of the Ruby Fields, but sat a short 2 blocks shy. He'd learned long ago never to walk into a world exactly where you wanted to be. If trouble were waiting, you'd land right on top of it.
"There's an inn in Red London," he explained,
trying not to think about the last time he was there, about the tracing spell and the attack and the corpses of the men in the alley beyond, corpses he'd made.
"I keep a room there," he went on. "It will have what I need to make a door to White London."
Lila didn't pick up on his use of "I" instead of "we," or if she did, she didn't bother to correct him. In fact, she seemed lost in her own thoughts as they wove through the network of back streets. Kell kept his chin up, his senses tuned.
"I'm not going to run into myself, am I?"
asked Lila, breaking the silence.
Kell glanced her way. "What are you talking about?"
She kicked a loose stone.
"Well, I mean, it's another world, isn't it? Another version of London. Is there another version of me?"
Kell frowned.
"I've never met anyone like you."
He hadn't meant it as a compliment, but Lila took it that way, flashing him a grin.
"What can I say?" she said. "I'm one of a kind."
Kell managed an echo of her smile, and she gasped.
"What's that on your face?"
The smile vanished.
"What?"
"Never mind," she said, laughing. "It's gone."
Kell only shook his head. He didn't grasp the joke, but whatever it was, it seemed to delight Lila, and she chuckled to herself all the way to Whitbury. As they turned onto the pleasant little lane, Kell came to a stop on the curb between two shop fronts. One belonged to a dentist and the other a barber. In Red London, it was an herbalist and stonesmith, and if Kell squinted, he could still see traces of his blood on the brick wall in front of him, the surface sheltered by a narrow overhang. Lila was staring intently at the wall.
"Is this where they are? Your rooms?"
"No," he said. "But this is where we go through."
Lila's fists clenched and unclenched at her side. He thought she must be frightened. But when she glanced his way, her eyes were bright, the edge of a smile on her lips. Kell swallowed and stepped up to the wall, and Lila joined him. He hesitated.
"What are we waiting for?"
"Nothing," said Kell. "It's just..."
He slipped out of his coat and wrapped it around her shoulders as if the magic could be so easily deceived.
As if it wouldn't know the difference between human and Antari.
He doubted his coat would make a difference, either the stone would let her through or it wouldn't, but he still relinquished it. In response, Lila fetched her kerchief, the one she'd given him when she picked his pocket and reclaimed when he passed out on her floor, and tucked it into his back pocket.
"What are you doing?" he asked.
"Seems right, somehow," she said. "You gave me something of yours, I'll give you something of mine. Now we're linked."
"It doesn't work that way," he said.
Lila shrugged.
"Can't hurt."
Kell supposed she was right. He slid his knife free and drew the blade across his palm, a thin line of blood welling up. He dabbed it with his fingers and made a mark on the wall.
"Take out the stone," he said.
Lila eyed him distrustfully.
"You'll need it," he pressed.
She sighed and pulled her broad-brim hat from a fold in her coat. It was crumpled, but with a flick of her wrist it unfolded, and she reached into the hat's bowl like a magician and drew out the black rock. Something in Kell twisted at the sight of it, an ache in his blood, and it took all his strength not to reach for the talisman. He bit back the urge and thought for the first time that perhaps it was better if he didn't hold it. Lila closed her fingers around the stone, and Kell closed his fingers around Lila's. And as it was, he could feel the talisman humming through the flesh and bone of her hand. He tried not to think about the way it sang to him. "Are you sure?" he asked one last time.
"It will work," said Lila.
Her voice sounded less certain now than it had been. Less like she believed and more like she wanted to, so Kell nodded.
"You said yourself," she added, "that everyone has a mix of humanity and magic in them. That means I do, too."
She turned her gaze up to his.
"What happens now?"
"I don't know," he said truthfully.
Lila drew closer, so close their ribs were touching, and he could feel her heart racing through them. She was so good at hiding it, her fear. It didn't show in her eyes or the lines of her face, but her pulse betrayed her. And then Lila's lips tugged into a grin, and Kell wondered if it was fear she felt after all, or something else entirely.
"I'm not going to die," she said. "Not till I've seen it."
"Seen what?"
Her smile widened.
"Everything."
Kell smiled back. And then Lila brought her free hand to his jaw and tugged his mouth toward hers. The kiss was there and then gone, like one of her smiles.
"What was that for?"
he asked, dazed.
"For luck,"
she said, squaring her shoulders to the wall.
"Not that I need it."
Kell stared at her a moment and then forced himself to turn toward the blood-stained bricks. He tightened his hand over hers, and he brought his fingers to the mark.
"As Travers," he said.
The wall gave way, and the traveller and the thief stepped forward and through. 3. Baron woke to a noise. It was the second time that morning. Noise was a fairly common thing in a tavern. The volume of it ebbed and flowed depending on the hour, but sometimes thunderous and others murmuring, but it was always there in some measure. Even when the pub was closed, the stone's throw was never truly silent. But Baron knew every kind of noise his tavern made, from the creak of the floorboards to the groan of the doors to the wind through the hundreds of cracks in the old walls. He knew them all. And this one was different. Baron had owned the tavern at the seam, for that was how he thought of the aching old building, for a very long time. Long enough to understand the strange that drifted past and in like debris. Long enough for the strange to seem normal. And while he was not a part of that strange, having no interest or affinity for the practicing of that strangeness others called magic, he had come to develop a sense of sorts, where the strange was concerned. And he listened to it, just as he listened now to the noise above his head. It wasn't loud, not at all, but it was out of place and brought with it a feeling under his skin and in his bones, a feeling of wrongness, of danger. The hair on his arm prickled and his heart, always steady, began to beat faster in warning. The noise came again, and he recognized the groan of footsteps on the old wooden floor. He sat up in his bed. Lila's room sat directly over his own, but the footsteps did not belong to Lila. When someone spends enough time under your roof, as Lila had beneath his, you come to know the kind of noise they make, not only their voices, but the way they move through a space. And Baron knew the sound of Lila's tread when she wanted to be heard, and the sound of her tread when she didn't. And this was neither. And besides, he had first woken to the sound of Lila and Kell leaving not long before. He had not stopped her, had long since learned that it was futile to try, and had long since resolved to be instead an anchor, there and ready when she wandered back, which she invariably did. But if Lila was not moving about her room, who was? Baron got to his feet, the shivery feeling of wrong worsening as he tugged the suspenders from his waist up onto his broad shoulders and pulled on his boots. A shotgun hung on the wall by the door, half rusted from disuse. On the occasion trouble brewed downstairs, Baron's hulking form was usually enough to quash it. Now he took hold of the gun by the barrel and pulled it down from its mount. He drew open the door, cringing as it groaned, and set off up the stairs to Lila's room. Stealth, he knew, was useless. Baron had never been a small man, and the steps creaked loudly under his boots as he climbed. When he reached the short green door at the top of the stairs, he hesitated and pressed his ear to the wood. He heard nothing, and for a brief moment he doubted himself, thought he'd slept too lightly after Lila's departure and simply dreamt the threat out of concern. His grip, which had been knuckles white on the shotgun, began to loosen, and he let out a breath and thought of going back to bed. But then he heard the metallic sound of coins tumbling and the doubt gutted like a candle. He threw open the door, shotgun raised. Lila and Kel were both gone, but the room was not empty. A man stood beside the open window, weighing Lila's silver pocket watch in the palm of his hand. The lantern on the table burned with an odd pale light that made the man look strangely colourless, from his charcoal hair to his pale skin to his faded grey clothes. When his gaze drifted up casually from the timepiece and settled on Baron, he seemed entirely unfazed by the gun. The tavern owner saw that one of his eyes was green. The other was pitch black. Lila had described the man to him and given him a name. Holland. Baron did not hesitate. He pulled the trigger, and the shotgun blasted through the room with a deafening sound that left his ears ringing. But when the plume of smoke cleared, the colourless intruder stood exactly where he'd been before the blast. Unharmed. Baron stared in disbelief. The air in front of Holland glittered faintly, and it took Baron a moment to grasp that it was full of shot pellets. The tiny metal beads hung suspended in front of Holland's chest. And then they fell, clattering to the floor like hail. Before Baron could squeeze off the second shot, Holland's fingers twitched and the weapon went flying out of Baron's hands and across the narrow room, crashing against the wall. He lunged for it, or at least he meant to, but his body refused, remaining firmly rooted to the spot, not out of fear, but something stronger. Magic. He willed his limbs to move, but the impossible force willed them still.
"Where are they?"
asked Holland. His voice was low and cold and hollow. A bead of sweat rolled down Baron's cheek as he fought the magic, but it was no use.
"Gone,"
he said, his voice a low rumble. Holland frowned, disappointed. He drew a curved knife from his belt.
"I noticed that."
He crossed the room with even echoing steps and brought the blade up slowly to Baron's throat. It was very cold and very sharp.
"Where have they gone?"
Up close, Kel smelled of lilies and grass. Holland smelled of ash and blood and metal. Baron met the magician's eyes. They were so like Kel's, and so different. Looking into them, he saw anger and hatred and pain. Things that never spread, never touched the rest of his face.
"Well?"
he pressed.
"No idea,"
growled Baron. It was the truth. He could only hope they were far away. Holland's mouth turned down.
"Wrong answer."
He drew the blade across, and Baron felt a searing heat at his throat. And then nothing. 9. Festival and Fire. 1. Red London welcomed Kel home as if nothing were wrong. It had not rained here, and the sky was streaked with wisps of cloud and crimson light, as if a reflection of the isle. Carriages rolled in rumbling fashion over street stones on their well-worn paths, and the air was filled with the sweet steam of spice and tea, and, farther off, the sounds of building celebration. Had it really been only a matter of hours since Cal had fled